3 weeks later, he used the homely metaphor to reassure Americans. It is a proper function of government to help build a sturdy floor over the pit of personal disaster. And to this objective, we are all committed. Eisenhower would be no Herbert Hoover. Among his first acts as president in March 1953 was the consolidation of such programs under a newly created Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Billed as an efficiency move, it also elevated the executive in charge of administering Social Security to cabinet rank. Ovita Culp Hobby, a Texan who had run the Women's Army Corps during the war, was tapped for the position. She then chaired a commission to recommend ways to extend Social Security to millions of workers who were not yet included. From its inception in 1935, the program had not been available to many self-employed professionals, including architects, dentists, accountants, lawyers, farm owners, farm workers, domestic workers, waiters and waitresses, fishermen and religious ministers. Many government workers and public school teachers were not included either. This gap in coverage hurt the industrious small business owner. It also hurt the women and minorities who toiled in service industries and domestic work without a social safety net. Eisenhower proposed to widen the scope of the program in a move that would add 10 million working people to the Social Security rolls. How did Ike square this extension of a welfare program with his conservative ideas about thrift and self-reliance? In typical fashion, he found a middle way. He rejected the argument that Social Security was some sort of government handout. In fact, it was available only to people who had worked and who had made contributions to the system. By asking workers and employers to set aside money for retirement, the government encouraged foresight and wise financial stewardship. Eisenhower believed that retirement systems, by which individuals contribute to their own security according to their own respective abilities, have become an essential part of our economic and social life. These systems are but a reflection of the American heritage of sturdy self-reliance, which has made our country strong and kept it free. The self-reliance without which we would have had no Pilgrim Fathers, no hardship-defying pioneers, and no eagerness today to push to ever-widening horizons in every aspect of our national life. In this way of thinking, receiving a benefit check in old age was a right citizens had earned through their industry and labor. In January 1954, he sent to Congress proposals for a wide array of welfare programs and enhancements, making the case in language that would have made his Republican predecessors, Hoover and Coolidge, choke on their breakfast oatmeal. We must make greater and more successful efforts than we have made in the past to strengthen Social Security and improve the health of our citizens. In so doing, we build for the future, and we prove to the watching world that a free nation can and will find the means, despite the tensions of these times, to progress toward a better society. Congress embraced Eisenhower's proposals for expanding Social Security and overwhelmingly approved his request. On September 1st, Eisenhower signed the Social Security Amendments of 1954, expanding coverage and benefits to an additional 10 million people. Social Security, once an embattled program and a symbol to conservatives of bloated federal spending, had become a permanent part of the American system. In a letter to his brother Edgar, a right-winger who had recently complained about the growth of federal programs, Ike explained this political reality. "It is true that I believe this country is following a dangerous trend when it permits too great a degree of centralization of government functions. I oppose this. In some instances, the fight is a rather desperate one." But he added, "The federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which the mass of the people firmly believe should be undertaken by it. Americans wanted the government to act as a safety net. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. If you Texas oil millionaires, and the occasional hardliner might still oppose Social Security. But," he said in memorably blunt terms, "their number is negligible, and they are stupid. 5. In truth, Eisenhower was not a small government conservative, although he successfully sold himself as one to the public. He believed government should create the conditions in which Americans could pursue their own ambitions. This implied not a small or diminished government, but an effective one. Good government should deliver meaningful enhancements to citizens within the limits of financial restraint. Ike believed in making government work for the little fellow, as he put it. And in particular, that meant providing Social Security, health care and insurance, housing, and highways. This principle of effective yet restrained government led Eisenhower to champion a program for national health insurance, a policy area of infamous complexity and entrenched interests. As early as his State of the Union message in January 1954, he expressed his convictions on the subject. "I'm flatly opposed to the socialization of medicine," he began predictably. But he did believe that with rising costs of medical care and health insurance, many Americans had no protection against sudden injury or illness. He floated the idea of a limited government reinsurance program to backstop private insurance companies and encourage them to offer broader protection to more families. In March 1954, the administration sent a proposal to Congress that would set up a $25 million fund, which the government would use to guarantee policies given to low-income or high-risk groups. HEW Secretary Ovita Hobby said the scheme would allow insurance companies to offer more insurance to a wider population while avoiding a national or socialized program. But in a stunning defeat for the president, the reinsurance bill was killed in the House of Representatives in July. A coalition of 162 Democrats who wanted a national health insurance program and 75 conservative Republicans who wanted no federal role at all in the health insurance business sank the legislation, aided and abetted by the American Medical Association. Eisenhower's frustration boiled over in a mid-July news conference. His goal was to bring good and fine medical care within reach of the average household budget. The House members who had defeated his bill just don't understand what are the facts of American life. Our people are not getting the kind of medical care to which they are entitled. The right-wing Chicago Tribune hailed the defeat, calling the scheme a political ploy to show the country that the Republicans now embrace the welfare state. But the Washington Post argued that the plan was the most hopeful middle-of-the-way measure yet devised to make health insurance affordable to 68 million uninsured people. The president reintroduced the proposal in 1955 and in 1956, but could never overcome its varied sources of opposition. Eisenhower had more success in steering public housing and urban development legislation through Congress. In the early 1950s, both political parties could agree that America's cities were facing a serious crisis of decay. As many white middle-class families moved to the suburbs, taking advantage of federal mortgage subsidies through the GI Bill, city centers began to lose residents, businesses, and taxes. In their place, less affluent families, immigrants and African Americans, took up residence in city neighborhoods and apartment blocks that were already in decline. In the eyes of many whites who yearned for their slice of the American dream, urban city centers began to look broken and dangerous, whereas modern suburban developments like the Levitt towns in New York and Pennsylvania glittered with the appeal of modernity and remained white thanks to racially restrictive covenants. The Truman administration developed a huge public housing program that aimed to build 800,000 new units of housing over 6 years to address the shortage of modern homes, while helping cities to retain residents. But Congress appropriated only a fraction of the money needed to carry out this building program, and most of the promised houses were never built. Eisenhower believed the federal government should encourage good housing and good neighborhoods as a way to produce good health and good citizenship, as he phrased it in his 1954 proposal to Congress for a new housing law. But simply building homes would make people more dependent upon government. So Eisenhower took a different tack. He appointed Albert Cole, a conservative Kansan who was a well-established foe of public housing, as his administrator of the Housing and Home Finance Agency. He also convened the Advisory Committee on Government Housing Policies, staffed entirely by leaders from the business, banking, and construction worlds. Their conclusions pushed Eisenhower to de-emphasize a direct federal role for public housing. Instead, he proposed to offer cities loans for slum clearance and land reclamation projects. For medium and low-income families, the Federal Housing Administration would provide low-interest loans. These forms of assistance were designed to rehabilitate urban areas and attract residents and new businesses, thus creating a self-sustaining cycle that would, in theory, repair urban blight while also enhancing economic growth. The Washington Post enthused about the plan, calling it a blitzkrieg against slum living and the most ambitious anti-slum battle in the nation's history. At the same time, though, the government significantly slowed its public housing projects to less than a quarter of what Truman had called for. Signed on August 2, 1954, the Housing Act of 1954 marked a sharp transition from a New Deal era that identified public housing as a responsibility of the federal government to an era of public-private partnership in which the government pursued pro-business policies favoring loans, easier mortgage terms, and urban redevelopment. Consequential as those achievements were, nothing demonstrates Ike's belief in the constructive possibilities of good government as much as his pursuit of a nationwide interstate highway system, perhaps his most enduring domestic initiative, and one that continues to shape the American landscape, environment, and economy. Biographers have long noted that Eisenhower first encountered the woeful American road network when he joined the Army's 1919 Transcontinental Road Convoy. This lumbering 3-mile-long caravan of surplus war vehicles left Washington, D.C. in early July on a publicity jaunt and arrived in San Francisco 2 months later. The conditions of the roads over which the convoy struggled showed Eisenhower that the nation could not flourish without significant internal infrastructure improvements. At a time when other nations, especially Germany, were investing in modern highways to boost economic growth, America remained stuck in second gear. Many American leaders had arrived at the same conclusion, but in the interwar years, road construction was considered a municipal and state matter. Traditionally, states planned their own road networks, raised the necessary money through bonds, taxes, and license fees, and then built roads with the purpose of serving local communities. The result was a skein of byways clogged with cars, motels, cafes, gas stations, and stoplights, impeding swift movement across the country. In a report drawn up during the war, federal road planners proposed a major change: the construction of a single integrated interstate highway system with common design standards and limited access, bypassing congested small-town America and allowing cars and trucks to move faster and farther. These plans led to the 1944 Federal Aid Highway Act, a blueprint for a 40,000-mile system of interstate highways. Congress, however, did not appropriate enough funds for the scheme, and so it was stillborn. Financing highway projects would be the great stumbling block Eisenhower had to address. Who would pay for such a massive public works project that would soon become the biggest peacetime construction project of any description ever undertaken by the United States or any other country? Eisenhower was preoccupied with the issue from the outset of his presidency, but in the fragile economic climate of 1953 to 54, he was wary of proposing such a massive project. Instead, with unemployment inching upward, he pushed highway building as a crash jobs program. The administration steered a stopgap highway bill through Congress in May 1954 that dedicated $2 billion to road maintenance and construction. But this fell short of a full-scale highway system, and Eisenhower kept up the pressure. In July 1954, he declared the nation's highways obsolete. Traffic accidents were taking too many lives, the president stated. Traffic jams wasted productive hours every day, and the economy was strangled by lack of adequate transport. He asked the Conference of Governors for help in designing a full-scale national interstate system, to be built over 10 years for $50 billion. The cost would be borne by tolls and gas taxes, he suggested, and it would require close federal-state cooperation. The governors remained skeptical, however, and Eisenhower realized he was going to have to generate pressure to get a plan drafted. In August 1954, he turned to one of his closest and most politically experienced friends, General Lucius Clay, to take control of the bureaucratic machinery and get a detailed proposal before Congress. Clay, an engineer by training who had supervised the American occupation of post-war Germany, also served on the board of General Motors and was an outspoken advocate for the auto industry. Getting roads built, he felt, was a vital economic necessity for the country and for business. Clay took command of the President's Advisory Committee on a National Highway Program and handpicked its members. Among them, Stephen Bechtel, a titan of the engineering industry. The committee toiled for 3 months, holding public hearings and consulting widely with engineers, planners, financial experts, trucking companies, auto companies, concrete manufacturers, and labor unions. In January 1955, Clay presented Eisenhower with a plan, whose numbers and scale were staggering. 41,000 miles of highway at a total cost of $101 billion, to be built in 10 years. To solve the knotty problem of financing, the Federal Highway Corporation would be chartered by Congress to sell 30-year bonds. These bonds would be paid back over time by the use of the gas tax, a revenue stream that would only increase as car travel and gas consumption rose. The corporation could fund the project, no tolls would be imposed on drivers, and the proposal envisioned no increase in federal taxes or debt. It sounded simple, but Clay's plan, which Eisenhower submitted to Congress in February 1955, met a buzzsaw of resistance from various quarters. The powerful chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Harry F. Byrd of Virginia, argued that the proposed Federal Highway Corporation represented an infringement of states' rights. Significantly, Byrd was at that time asserting states' rights to try to block implementation of the Supreme Court's 1954 desegregation decision. Trucking companies protested the reliance on gas taxes, which cut into their profit margins. Farmers opposed the emphasis on a limited access road network that would cut off their local routes from the highway system. City and state officials wanted to protect their right to plan local routes based on local needs rather than accept federal directives. They wanted to take gas tax revenues and design their own roads. Many critics thought the bond issuance, which would require the government to pay back $11 billion in interest to bond purchasers, wasted valuable funds that ought to be spent on roads. Eisenhower tried to cajole congressional leaders into seeing his plan as a sensible, prudent response to a national emergency. He even used the specter of a nuclear attack to justify highway building, pointing out that evacuation of cities in wartime required better roads. Without a crash program of highway building, the economy would suffocate, national defense would be harmed, and we will have a terrible condition in this country. We must build new roads. Few could disagree with the goal, but many disagreed with the plan to pay for it. Bonds, tolls, gas taxes, some combination of all three. Eisenhower's road plan got tangled up in congressional committees in the summer of 1955, and by the time of the August recess, no law had been passed. The president went off to Denver for a vacation, a prolonged one, as it turned out, without having a highway bill to sign. Yet Eisenhower had one ace in the hole. All the major parties to the debate wanted a highway bill, and eventually a compromise was found. It was sketched out by Congressman George Fallon, Democrat of Maryland, who served on the House Public Works Committee. Fallon replaced the bond issue with a proposal to create a highway trust fund supplied by slightly increased taxes on gasoline, diesel oil, tires, trucks, buses, and trailers. The proposal promised to bring in a constant, indeed constantly increasing, stream of revenue into the trust fund, and it stipulated that money so raised could be used only for highway building and no other public works. The highways would be built without any federal budget appropriations. Only a small user fee in the form of gas and excise taxes was needed to create a self-perpetuating machine. Gas taxes would be spent on new roads that would allow greater traffic, which in turn would consume more gasoline, providing more revenue to spend on more roads, leading to more gas consumption and so more tax revenue. In May and June 1956, both houses of Congress passed the legislation, and on June 29th the President signed into law the Interstate Highway Act of 1956. The law reflected Eisenhower's political philosophy. It married government initiative with technocratic expertise in the service of market-enhancing public projects. In return for effective government, the public could be fairly asked to pay a small additional tax to support it. 6. By the end of his second year in office, Eisenhower had accumulated a number of significant legislative achievements, and more seemed well on the way. In areas such as infrastructure, housing, health care, and social security, his administration had made progress and cut federal spending at the same time. As the midterm elections of November 1954 loomed, Ike hoped this strong record would translate into victories at the congressional level for Republicans. Both chambers were in GOP hands, but the margin of control was razor thin, and Eisenhower wanted to expand it. He and Nixon threw themselves into campaigning. Ike gave 40 political speeches in the fall of 1954 and traveled 10,000 miles on behalf of candidates. Nixon worked tirelessly and in typical fashion slammed the Democrats as the party of communism, cowardice, and corruption. But these efforts could not forestall a significant defeat at the polls. The GOP lost control of both the House, where the Democrats took 17 seats, and the Senate, where the Democrats gained 2. It was a slap in the face for the president. He now had to preside over a divided government. In a post-mortem on the elections, Eisenhower and some of his close advisers drew the conclusion that the Republican Party was in a dangerous position. It could win national elections only when a genuine political phenomenon like Eisenhower stood at the top of the ticket. Without such a known vote-getter pulling everyone else along, GOP candidates struggled. The party remained divided between far-right conservatives and moderates, and had no clear vision or platform to offer voters that could contest the Democratic legacy of the New Deal. Ike had been mulling over this problem since coming to Washington, entangling with the Taft wing of his party. From time to time he would vent his feelings in his diary or in letters to friends. As early as April 1953, he speculated about forming a new party under the banner The Middle Way. It would gather those who were internationalists in foreign policy, fiscal conservatives who wanted a balanced budget, and social liberals who understood the need for a basic safety net to catch those who, through no fault of their own, suddenly find themselves poverty-stricken. Between those who wanted socialism and those who sought to eliminate everything the federal government has ever done, there had to be some common ground. Mere hostility to government was not a winning formula. In the wake of the disastrous midterms, Eisenhower decided that the answer to his party's problems was to embrace the middle of the road as a political strategy. It would not be easy. He told a gathering of his close advisers that the time had come to start the fight against the old guard within our party. If the GOP was to have a chance of winning majorities in the future, it first had to reform itself by bringing forward the progressive moderates in the party. In his diary, he spelled it out clearly. The Republican Party must be known as a progressive organization, or it is sunk. As 1955 opened, Eisenhower began consciously to shape a political message that would appeal to the nation's moderates and independents. His January 2, 1955 State of the Union address carefully outlined proposals that balanced fiscal restraint against expanded social welfare projects and a robust defensive policy. From time to time, Eisenhower floated the term moderate progressive to describe this platform. But in February 1955, in a speech to the Republican National Committee, He coined a phrase that captured his ambitions. The Republicans must champion dynamic conservatism. Here was a winning formula that suggested generous and humane solutions to social problems within a framework of fiscal restraint, moral rectitude, and a scrupulous observance of states' rights. The right wing had bucked at this. The Chicago Tribune whined, "We cannot see what purpose was served by Republicans fighting the New Deal for 20 years if they were going to wind up by embracing the New Deal." But that sort of carping could not contend with the rousing chorus of approval from Republican activists who understood what a godsend Eisenhower was for their party. At its national meeting, the Republican National Committee, RNC, now under the direction of former New York Congressman Leonard Hall, passed a glowing, worshipful resolution praising Eisenhower in language that bordered on a cult of personality. "In Dwight Eisenhower, we have a political leader whose vigor, judgment, and wisdom have breathed fresh life, energy, and determination into our party organization." There was something godly about the man. "I could become," the party leader stated, "not only the political leader, but the spiritual leader of our times. We thank him and salute him." No doubt this deeply embarrassed Eisenhower. Yet it revealed the degree to which the party embraced his middle way and jettisoned the principles of the more conservative Taft faction. Political analysts caught on to Ike's emphasis on reforming his party and banishing the ghosts of Coolidge and Hoover. New York Times columnist Arthur Kroc saw that Ike had drawn a key lesson from the November 1954 defeat. The Republican Party must accept the political verities of the second half of the 20th century instead of indulging in nostalgia for the dead past and continuing to run against Presidents Roosevelt and Truman. In early August 1955, just as he was preparing to depart for his long-awaited Denver vacation, Eisenhower casually spoke to a group of Republican congressional staff workers and once again stressed the centrist ambitions of Eisenhower Republicanism. "It is idle to say that the federal government can be standoffish toward the needs of the people," he said in the steaming August heat on the White House lawn. "Certainly the Republican Party must identify itself with economic freedom and individualism, but we must never be a party that is indifferent to the sufferings of a great community where, through some unusual cause, people are out of work, where people can't educate their own children, where through any kind of disaster, natural or economic, people are suffering." Eisenhower thought these ideas formed a middle way philosophy that could transform the Republican Party into the majority party in the United States. If only his loyalists would simply follow his advice. Chapter 11. To the Summit. I believe mankind longs for freedom from war and rumors of war. 1. By the start of 1955, Eisenhower had attained extraordinary popularity and prestige in American public life. He had tamed the war in Korea and avoided American entanglement in Indochina. He had brought fiscal balance back to Washington. He had guided the nation through a brief recession and ushered in an era of robust economic growth. His expansion of Social Security aided millions. His defanging of McCarthy won him wide respect. Even his tepid support of civil rights for African Americans aligned with public opinion in much of the nation. And in July 1955, he pulled off yet another success. He traveled to Geneva to meet with the heads of government of Britain, France, and the Soviet Union in an effort to ease Cold War tensions. It was the first time since 1945, when Stalin, Truman, and Churchill had met at Potsdam, that American and Soviet leaders had convened. The intervening decade had been a time of great anxiety, political upheaval, war, and an intensified nuclear arms race. The meeting in Geneva brought a break in the clouds, a moment when world leaders talked peace and when great power war, which had once seemed inevitable, began at last to look unlikely. Eisenhower basked in what was quickly dubbed the spirit of Geneva. The Geneva summit of 1955 grew principally from the need of the new post-Stalin leaders in the Kremlin to show the world a moderate face. The collective leadership that replaced Stalin had stumbled for a while in finding a strategy for waging the Cold War. But by the spring of 1955, when Nikita Khrushchev emerged as the dominant figure in the Soviet government, a new look began to take shape. This bellicose, rotund Ukrainian with a bald head and a menacing grin had been one of Stalin's closest associates in the 1930s and during the war years. A belligerent ideologue, he now held the post of First Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Yet he saw that Stalin's foreign policy had failed to win security and stability for his country. Stalin's brutal behavior had triggered a robust Western response, from the infusion of Marshall Plan dollars to the creation of NATO and the rearming of Western Germany. Most worrisome, the United States had developed a massive arsenal of nuclear weapons and the aircraft to deliver them anywhere in the world. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was still poor and relatively weak. Its atomic weapons arsenal was a fraction of America's, and its hold on its Eastern European satellites was uncertain, as uprisings in Berlin in 1953 revealed. Soviet interests, Khrushchev believed, would best be served by a period of peaceful coexistence with the West, rather than direct confrontation. To signal his willingness to temper the conflict with the West, Khrushchev took some notable steps. In early 1955, the Soviets acquiesced to the long-standing Western demand to evacuate neutral Austria and end the four-power occupation of that country. He also made a major break with Stalin's policy by traveling to Belgrade to curry favor with Marshal Josip Tito, the Yugoslav communist whom Stalin had declared an apostate and traitor to the Marxist cause. Khrushchev also applauded the meeting in Bandung, Indonesia, of world leaders from 29 African and Asian nations. Even though these states declared themselves to be non-aligned in the Cold War, they aired their grievances about the capitalist and colonial world order, much to Khrushchev's delight. To cap off this period of activity, Khrushchev put public pressure on the Western powers to convene a major international summit to resolve such issues as the division of Germany, the militarization of Europe, and the nuclear arms race. Eisenhower initially rebuffed the idea of a summit with the Soviets, even saying in a news conference in April, "I see no reason for that summit meeting." In a private conversation, Ike said he perceived no fundamental changes in communist motives or objectives, just a shift in tactics. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles agreed, and strongly. Dulles believed that Khrushchev's charm offensive sprang from fundamental weakness. The Soviet economy had failed to meet basic consumer needs. The subventions to satellite states in Eastern Europe and China had become a costly burden, and the Russians were struggling to keep up with the Americans in the arms race. Dulles concluded that the Soviets wanted a pause in the geopolitical contest, and he was not inclined to give them one. In fact, Dulles feared that a summit would merely give Khrushchev and his frontman, the nominal head of state Nikolai Bulganin, a world stage to propose a series of bold ideas about uniting Germany, disarming Europe, and halting the arms race. Such ploys would play well in Europe and in the Third World, and might lead to the weakening of the NATO alliance that Dulles had toiled so long to secure. In short, a summit promised only risk and no reward. So, why agree to meet the Soviets at all? Eisenhower, unlike Dulles, felt he could not appear senselessly stubborn, as he put it later. If proposals for peace and reconciliation were on the table, America must at least consider them. The public in America and in Europe, so accustomed to bad news about the great power rivalry, had been heartened by signs of a softening coming from Moscow. Intransigence now would be bad publicity for the United States. British leaders felt even more pressure. On April 6, 1955, Anthony Eden took over as Prime Minister from an ailing Winston Churchill. Eden, the suave, handsome Tory and longtime foreign minister, had toiled for years in Churchill's shadow. Given the top job at long last, he announced a general election so as to strengthen his parliamentary mandate. This was set for May 26th. The announcement of a great summit meeting to discuss peace with world leaders would help his campaign against the much more neutralist Labour Party. American officials in London reported to Dulles that the British are disarmingly frank in acknowledging their proposals for talks with the Soviets are aimed at the local electorate. In a personal message, Prime Minister Eden pleaded with Eisenhower to agree to a meeting of the Big Four world leaders. Despite Dulles's serious reservations, Ike relented. Privately, he told Eden that he feared raising false hopes about a breakthrough in the Cold War stalemate. But he understood the political imperative of embracing the cause of peace and détente. The date for a meeting with the Soviet, British, French, and American heads of state was set for July 18th to 23rd, 1955, in Geneva. For the next 6 weeks, the National Security Staff spun itself into a frenzy preparing for the great meeting. One of the major issues they expected the Soviets to press was the reunification and neutralization of Germany, a plan unacceptable to the Americans, but appealing to many Germans. Another probable Soviet gambit would concentrate on disarming Central Europe, perhaps even creating a demilitarized zone in some or all of Europe, a suggestion that struck at the heart of the large American military presence across Europe, and that would weaken NATO. And the great powers would likely tangle over the question of nuclear weapons. What if the USSR called for a nuclear arms freeze, or even a radical proposal like the abolition of nuclear weapons? The veteran newsman Joseph Alsop captured the pre-conference buzz in Washington very nicely when he wrote in his column, "Immense numbers of position papers were laboriously prepared, but essentially the aim was to prevent anything awful happening at the summit, rather than to make anything good happen there. Most of the position papers took the form, if the Soviets make move A concerning Germany, then we must make move B to secure a checkmate." But on one matter, the arms race, American planners were genuinely torn. And it was here that Eisenhower would play a decisive role in shaping the Geneva meeting. The issue of nuclear weapons most worried American planners because it was the one that had the greatest influence in the public mind. By 1955, the superpowers had attained the ability to detonate hydrogen bombs of extraordinary power. Nuclear war would certainly mark the end of civilization. It was imperative that in public, at least, American officials recognize the deep desire of the world's people to step back from the brink and impose some reasonable limits on atomic weapons. And yet, as government officials debated the appropriate American position, serious cleavages opened. The Pentagon and its military chiefs held an intransigent point of view. America's nuclear arsenal was the best defense against a Soviet attack. It had already proven effective in limiting Soviet expansion. The limitation of nuclear arms would only help the Soviets in their bid for strategic parity with the United States. The USSR looked weak, and the military chiefs wanted to hold the Soviets' feet to the fire. Such inflexibility annoyed Eisenhower. In a tense meeting of the National Security Council at the end of June, the president directly challenged Admiral Radford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, calling the arms race a mounting spiral towards war. If Radford really believed that arms agreements could never be advantageous, then perhaps the United States should go to war at once with the Soviet Union. Defense Secretary Wilson chimed in, backing up Radford. Atomic weapons were essential to countering the Soviet advantage in military manpower in Europe and Chinese manpower in Asia. Without them, the communists would have an overwhelming advantage. Eisenhower did not give up, however. While he knew that any serious agreement limiting nuclear arms was unlikely, he did not wish to go to Geneva only to obstruct the meeting. He wanted to put an arms proposal on the table that would at least test the willingness of the Soviets to negotiate. He was, he said, much intrigued with an idea of mutual inspection of military installations, even before an arms agreement was reached. This idea had been circulating among his various strategy planners for some time, as one of many proposals the Americans might make. For Eisenhower, this one seemed to have the most appeal. If both the USSR and the United States agreed to open their arms installations to public inspection, this act alone might serve as a foundation for arms reductions and confidence building. At the very least, such mutual inspections might help penetrate the veil of Soviet intentions. More crucial, Ike believed, his trip to Geneva needed some kind of big, positive action on this front. If America emphasized only military solutions to all these great problems, he declared, it would lose the support of the world. These ruminations by the president led Foster Dulles to despair. This cautious, rigid, and suspicious man knew that Eisenhower wanted to make a bold gesture of peace and reconciliation, and he was terrified that he would go too far. All the patient work of building up the Western alliance and isolating the Soviet Union might be given away in a flash merely to placate public opinion. 2 days before he left for Geneva, Dulles invited a fellow Cold War hawk, C.D. Jackson, to his home for dinner, and unburdened himself of his fears. Eisenhower, Dulles confessed, is so inclined to be humanly generous, to accept a superficial tactical smile as evidence of inner warmth, that he might, in a personal moment with the Russians, accept a promise or a proposition at face value, and upset the apple cart. The looming danger was that Ike's behavior might smack of appeasement. A word Dulles used, and then retracted as if it were too poisonous to utter. If that happened, Dulles's career, built upon his ferocious anti-communism, would be in tatters. Dulles felt he could go toe-to-toe with the Soviets and give up nothing, but Eisenhower always wanted to avoid confrontation, and believed a handshake could make a difference. Sighing into his after-dinner drink, Dulles said, I would hate to see the whole edifice undermined, in response to a smile. 2. Just an hour before his departure to Europe on the evening of July 15, 1955, Eisenhower sat down behind his desk in the Oval Office, faced a bank of cameras and microphones, and addressed the nation. His worries about raising public expectations had apparently vanished. He declared that for the first time in American history, a president was traveling overseas to engage in a conference with the heads of other governments in order to prevent wars, in order to see whether, in this time of stress and strain, we cannot devise measures that will keep from us this terrible scourge that afflicts mankind. In Geneva, he wished to conciliate, to understand, to be tolerant, to try to see the other fellow's viewpoint. Throwing aside his earlier caution, he now asserted that the great powers had a chance to take the greatest step toward peace, toward future prosperity and tranquility that has ever been taken in the history of mankind. With soaring rhetoric like this crackling across the national airwaves, no wonder Dulles was worried. To cap this remarkable peroration, Ike asked the people of the nation to pray. Suppose, on the next Sabbath day, observed by each of our religions, Americans, 165 million of us, went to our accustomed places of worship and, crowding those places, asked for help, and by doing so, demonstrated to all the world the sincerity and depth of our aspirations for peace. This would be a mighty force. Eisenhower's flock obeyed. Clergymen of all denominations offered blessings to the president as he set off to Europe. The World Council of Churches appealed for special prayers. At St. Patrick's Cathedral and at Temple Emmanuel in New York, fervent orisons could be heard. Day-long vigils were held across the country as millions of worshippers asked for divine blessings upon the Big Four peacemakers. Some religious leaders chose to get as close as possible to the action. Billy Graham appeared in Geneva at the opening of the summit, setting up a revival meeting in a public park, where he led prayers for the world leaders. Graham joined in the chorus of heightened expectations, saying, "The next 6 days may be the most important in the history of the world." The president traveling on the presidential aircraft Columbine with Mamie and their son Major John Eisenhower, who served as Ike's aide for the conference, arrived in Geneva on July 16th. They were welcomed at the airport by a small Swiss military band and the Swiss president, Max Petitpierre. Speaking into a microphone on the tarmac, Eisenhower recalled that 11 years earlier he had come to Europe at the head of a great war machine to destroy Nazism. Now he came as an ambassador of peace. The 1,500 reporters far outnumbered the curious civilian onlookers. Mamie, holding an enormous bouquet of dark red roses, followed Ike to a waiting limousine, and they were whisked off through empty streets to a glamorous 18th-century chateau on the shore of icy blue Lake Geneva. The next morning, a quiet Sunday, the president and his son escaped from the official residence to attend services at the small American church in Geneva, where an African-American singer, Fanny Jones, then studying music in the city, sang the Negro spiritual, "Sweet Little Jesus Boy." Billy Graham was in attendance that day, and looking at Eisenhower in church with his head bowed, remarked to a friend, "I believe God is really on the side of that man." The conference opened on Monday morning, July 18th, at the Palais des Nations, a sprawling white neoclassical behemoth that once housed the ill-fated League of Nations. As the world leaders took their places, Nikolai Bulganin for the USSR, Eden for Britain, Eisenhower for America, and Prime Minister Edgar Faure for France, it became apparent that there would be no private meeting of the minds. James Reston of the New York Times wrote, "The four leaders are sitting around four vast tables flanked by hordes of officials and addressing one another as if they were at a public meeting. Officials are banked around the principals like ringside spectators at a championship prize fight." British Foreign Minister Harold Macmillan, a friend of Eisenhower's from the war years, confessed that his heart sank as he looked out over the cavernous hall. The walls were decorated with vast, somewhat confused frescoes depicting the end of the world, or the Battle of the Titans, or the Rape of the Sabines, or a mixture of all three. I could conceive of no arrangement less likely to lead to intimate or useful negotiations. This formal atmosphere encouraged ponderous moralizing. The four leaders took turns laying out their positions, restating views that were already well known and on which they appeared to be inflexible. Premier Bulganin, a figurehead closely controlled by Khrushchev, mouthed the tired old argument calling for the withdrawal of foreign troops from Europe, an end to NATO, and only then the unification of Germany. The Americans wanted Germany unified and kept in NATO. The British offered a tepid proposal for a European security pact that would include all the major powers. The French, in a reprise of Eisenhower's Adams for Peace proposal, offered a plan to take all the money the world spent on nuclear arms and place it in a fund for the development of third world countries. All of these airy ideas fell harmlessly to the marble floors of the great meeting hall. Yet once the leaders adjourned from their set peace exercises at the conference table, little ripples of cordiality began to radiate through the meeting rooms. Between breaks, the delegations chattered around groaning tables of food and drink, and the quartet of leaders entertained one another at dinners and cocktails throughout the week, allowing some spontaneous discussions. The Soviets were surprisingly warm hosts, Macmillan recalled, offering guests at their evening dinners large tumblers of vodka and giving heartfelt toasts to the memory of the great Second World War alliance. In these informal settings, the Eisenhower magic had an opportunity to shine. One observer noted that Eisenhower's "Man from Abilene" style impressed the Soviets, and his earnest, sincere declarations seemed to disarm their suspicions. Ike showed off his talent as the great pacifier, the master of the sweeping generalization. He spoke unceasingly about building a bridge between East and West, prompting one reporter to ask, "How many bridges can he build in one afternoon?" Long on gestures of warmth, Ike was short on detail. He has shunned specifics like the plague. Eisenhower put his sincerity to work outside the conference meetings. On July 18, he hosted a dinner at his villa for Khrushchev, Bulganin, and Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov. With Molotov seated on his left and Bulganin on his right, Eisenhower regaled the men with a detailed analysis of his campaign in Normandy from D-Day to the liberation of France. Bulganin, who had been a lifelong apparatchik in the security services and had served as defense minister before taking over as nominal head of state under Khrushchev's patronage, peppered the president with questions. Evidently, he knew little about American military operations in Europe in 1944-45. As the evening wore on, Bulganin, a rotund man with a white goatee and an amiable laugh, frequently expressed the warmest feelings of friendship for the American people and for the president. The two men returned again and again to the futility of war in the atomic age. Even Dulles, having received a respectful toast from his old nemesis Molotov, was touched by the change in the Soviet's tone. 2 days later, Eisenhower invited Marshal Georgi Zhukov, the great battle commander and conqueror of the German Wehrmacht, for a private luncheon. One of the Second World War's heroes, Zhukov had been sidelined by Stalin as a possible rival and threat, but he had returned to prominence since Stalin's death and now served as defense minister. The two men spoke as friends and seasoned warriors. They had a remarkably open and wide-ranging discussion whose theme was the urgent need to restore good U.S.-Soviet relations despite their differing systems of government. The lunch concluded with a casual discussion of trout fishing, a passion the men shared. In all these exchanges, the heads of government agreed to little of substance. But after so many years of frozen hostility, these warm currents of sympathy promoted good feeling and optimism. By the end of the third day of meetings, however, the atmosphere in the meeting hall had become strained. Bulganin continued to read speeches clearly prepared for him by others. Khrushchev seemed to the Westerners to be the real circus master. Macmillan was amazed. How can this fat, vulgar man, with his pig eyes and ceaseless flow of talk, really be the head, the aspirant czar, of all these millions of people in this vast country? The summit began to look like a failure. But then Eisenhower made a move that he had carefully planned ahead of time. He had been drawn to the idea of a mutual weapons inspection program that would open both American and Soviet military installations to regular monitoring. Given the intense security and secrecy that had always surrounded military bases in both countries, this seemed a quixotic idea at best. Yet the context helps explain Eisenhower's thinking. Just a few months earlier, James Killian had made his heart-stopping presentation in the White House about the vulnerabilities of the United States to a surprise attack. In reply, the president had ordered a rapid program to get the U-2 spy plane operational. Its first test run would come in August. Eisenhower desperately wanted the information the secret overflights would provide to be sure that the USSR was not preparing a major attack. But how much easier it would be if both sides simply opened their skies to aircraft for approved overflights. Photographs would make plain the size of the arsenals and their state of readiness. In theory, such information, publicly gathered, would raise confidence and ease tensions. Ike hinted at this in Geneva in his very first conversation with his British and French allies. Instead of arguing about how to reduce weapons, why not simply allow inspections of the existing arsenals? If this were done, the president mused, what would be left to a potential aggressor? His capability for surprise would be severely limited. On the evening of July 20th, Eisenhower summoned to his villa his chief advisors on the disarmament problem, including Nelson Rockefeller, who had been serving since 1954 as a special assistant on foreign affairs, Harold Stassen, Admiral Radford, and NATO's commander General Alfred Grunther. Sitting in the library with this powerful cohort, the president made plain his intention to push the idea of mutual inspections of military bases as a preliminary step in a broader disarmament plan. In order to capitalize on the propaganda value of the proposal, the advisers agreed that no word of the plan would be shared beforehand with the British or French. The men also counseled the president to make his announcement in more or less extemporaneous fashion, as part of his longer speech on disarmament the following day. And that is just how Ike handled it. When, on the afternoon of July 21st, the Big Four met to discuss disarmament, Eisenhower took the floor to present a general statement on the desirability of reducing world armaments. It was platitudinous. Halfway through, he stopped, removed his reading glasses, looked directly at Bulganin, and spoke as if off the cuff. His words were simple and moving, though carefully prepared. He said he had been searching his hardened mind for a suitable demonstration of the good faith of the United States in the search for peace, and he hit upon this: to give each other a complete blueprint of our military establishments, from beginning to end, from one end of our countries to the other. In this scheme, each nation would provide within our countries facilities for aerial photography to the other country. Each side could take unlimited photographs, study them, and so build certainty that neither side was preparing any great surprise attack, and so lessening the dangerous and relaxing tensions. The Soviets, experts at making ringing declarations for propaganda purposes, scoffed at Eisenhower's proposal. After the president finished his remarks, Khrushchev sidled up to him and said, "Mr. President, we do not question the motive with which you put forward this proposal. But in effect, whom are you trying to fool? In our eyes, this is a very transparent espionage device." With a hint of contempt, Khrushchev added, "You could hardly expect us to take this seriously." Eisenhower stuck to his script. The plan offered to share information equally. Neither side would benefit more than the other. "We need," Ike insisted, "a departure from established custom." But Khrushchev dismissed the scheme as worthless and a distraction from the real need to reduce weapons. His response was 100% negative. But at a summit starved for signs of real progress, Eisenhower's visionary proposal captivated world opinion, just as he hoped it would. His suggestion was hailed in West German papers as revolutionary. The London Daily Mail called the speech the greatest of Eisenhower's career. The British Labour Party paper, the Daily Herald, considered the idea amazing. Even the French communist paper, L'Humanité, thought the scheme sensational. "Its chances of acceptance must be almost nil," noted the British News Chronicle. But it was a ringing testament of the idealism which is prepared to fight for peace at any cost. When the conference came to an end on July 23rd, the professional diplomats called it a failure. The U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, Charles Bolin, thought it the most disappointing and discouraging of all the summit meetings, and he had been present at the great wartime meetings between Stalin and Roosevelt. There was no real progress on the major issues, and though the foreign ministers would continue to meet in the following months, they produced no breakthroughs. But for Eisenhower personally, the summit had been a magnificent success. Ike transformed a meeting he initially opposed into a triumph for his style of politics. He won a moral victory, the New York Times asserted, by stressing his desire for peace and making innovative proposals for arms inspections. He represented what is best in this nation. He persuaded a skeptical world that the United States is sincerely opposed to war, cold or hot. He also imposed his will over his truculent Secretary of State, his chief military advisers, and many on the right in his own party, who viewed conciliation toward the Soviets as tantamount to appeasement. These achievements testified to Eisenhower's genuine political prowess. When he arrived back in Washington, he was met at the airport by 2,000 well-wishers in a summer rainstorm. Much of the cabinet stood in line to greet the returning peacemaker, who beamed through the downpour and happily shook every hand. Then he went directly to church and offered powerful thanks. The press churned out page after page of glowing reports of Eisenhower's triumph in Geneva. Nothing much had happened, reporters admitted, but even so, I could prompt a global sigh of relief. With instinctive sureness and the disarming conviction of his almost boyish manner, he convinced the world's people of his desire for peace. The big figure of the American president, perfectly tailored, vigorous,